Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Hey everybody, you got Mark here from the Negotiations Ninja podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. Today, my amazing guest is Mr. Dan Shapiro, writer, author of the amazing book, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, and then one he co-wrote with Roger Fisher called Beyond Reason. We talked today a lot about negotiating the non-negotiable. What are non-negotiable items, and are they truly non-negotiable? How do we approach those subjects? Is there a way for us to strategize with all this kind of stuff? Do we approach these conflict-based situations that are just seem to be set up for some sort of tenuous situation, and yet non-negotiable items get negotiated? And so we talk with Dan all about that today. I think you're going to love this interview. I certainly enjoyed the conversation. Love it when I talk to Dan. Enjoy this great discussion with Mr. Dan Shapiro. Dan, we made it, man. How are you, Pat?
I am doing well. It is great to connect with you, Mark.
Yeah, lovely to have you on the show. I'm super stoked to have this conversation because as a fan of your work and a fan of your writing for some time, I've been wanting to have this conversation for some time. So having you on is a real privilege. So thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you. It is an honor to be here.
So there are some people, surprisingly, who don't know who you are. So let's tell those people who you are, what your background is, and maybe some of the books that you've written.
Sure. So my name's Dan Shapiro, and the focus of my work is on negotiation and conflict resolution. I'm a professor based at Harvard. I run a program there called the Harvard International Negotiation Program. And really briefly, I got involved in this field about 30 years ago, initially doing work in Eastern and Central Europe, helping with the transition there from a closed to open society. In particular, how do people deal with conflict as they move from a communist political system more to an open society capitalistic one? How do you deal with conflict in that kind of society? So worked all around, worked with businesses, worked with governments, families in crisis, hostage negotiators, a little bit of everything, you know, and have learned a tremendous amount through all of that.
Fantastic. Still learning a lot, man. I love that you started this off with like talking about how you transition from like a communist society, basically, and the conflict that is inherent in that, because in a lot of your work, you talk a lot about challenging sacred areas and, you know, these ideas that we hold on to that are core to our identity. And that's sort of where I want to start the conversation, especially when we start thinking about negotiating the non-negotiable, your most recent work. Some of the things that you talk about in there are around the identity that we have in negotiation. Yep. and that we bring to the table. And so many people, I think, when they start negotiating, they don't necessarily think that they're bringing a quote-unquote identity to that table. So for the listeners, could you tell the listeners about what identity is, especially in the context of negotiation, and how that sometimes can be challenged, or how we need to be firm in our identity when we come to the table?
No, it's great. So I should have mentioned most of my work is around these deeper human dimensions of conflict and negotiation. Just imagine two business people sitting at the negotiation table trying to make a sale. One's trying to make the sale, the other's interested in a possible buy. Most people, when we think about negotiation, focus at the rational level of negotiation. What are each side's positions? What are their underlying interests? What does each side want? And it becomes somewhat of a chess game. But negotiation is much more than just a chess game, because underlying that whole rational dimension is this emotional dimension. I don't like you. You don't like me. I'm frustrated by what you just said. The offer that you gave me is completely outlandish. The emotions come into the negotiation very quickly. And there, beneath emotion, however, there's this deeper dimension, which is the realm of identity. Who am I? Who are you? And as we try to make that deal to interact effectively, how do those perceptions of one another affect the process and the outcome of the negotiation? And so identity to me, generally, it's all of those characteristics that define who we are as an individual or as a part of a group.
You talk about the two different types or two aspects of identity in your book, where you say, you know, there's this core identity and then a relational identity. Yeah. What are those two identities and why make that distinction?
When I've been doing work internationally in context of war, there was this obvious problem that struck me that each side is so deeply entrenched in their own identity, they're not going to change it. You know, the Israelis are going to stay Israelis. The Palestinians are going to stay Palestinians. They have a fixed identity. I call it the core identity. It's largely fixed. And my notion was, boy, if the only kind of identity we have is a fixed identity, we are stuck in a lot of conflicts here. Yeah, well, I should say in the United States. Canada has its own complex kinds of conflicts, but certainly the United States with polarization right now, Republicans not going to completely convert to a Democrat's way of thinking or vice versa. What do you do? And it occurred to me that we have different kinds of identity. In addition to this core, sort of fixed kind of identity of who we are, is what I call your relational identity. What are the characteristics that define who I am in relation to you, Mark, or you in relation to me?
Right.
And this goes back to questions of how emotionally connected do we feel with one another? How free do we feel to do what we want to do without the other imposing upon our ways of being? All those kinds of things. And that becomes more fluid. You know, I think that when we look at large-scale conflict resolution efforts, for example, becomes the place of opportunity. Because I feel like we're getting so theoretical, but we'll go there.
Yeah, let's go down the rabbit hole, so to speak.
But the core identity is sort of like a pillar. It doesn't change very easily, but the space between us, that is much more fluid. My wife and I, we are very different people. My core identity in terms of religion, in terms of the way I'm a night person, she's a morning person, a lot of differences from my wife. That's the core identity. I'm never going to change her and she's not going to change me as much as she wants to. You know? However, we can work to affect the nature of our relationship. And that relationship takes on its own identity, and that's where possibility rests, I think. And it's just as true, by the way, in the business negotiation as well.
So within that core identity, we have these, what you call the five pillars of identity, right? Where you speak about convictions, loyalties, all that kind of stuff. And that's core to who we are. But then we've got to start discussing, okay, if we're going to reduce the conflict or at least get to some sort of an agreement solution, there's this relational identity that has to be developed in this. How is that different than the core identity? And is that, you say that's more fluid. How do we generate fluidity in the discussion so that we can come to you being more amenable to change?
It's simple things. At some very crux level, it is about building a good relationship with the other side. I think too often people walk into negotiations, business, political negotiations, automatically assuming it is me versus you. It's the buyer versus the seller, and we're going to battle it out. It is the Israeli versus the Palestinian and vice versa. And you, like, we're constructing a certain way of being with one another that does not allow for optimal outcomes. You know, if you and I are enemies, Mark, and we're trying to negotiate, boy, I'm not going to share very much information with you. I'm not going to be very loyal to you. I'm not going to be loyal to our outcomes. You're probably going to be the same way. On the other hand, if we can shift the nature, sort of the structure of our relationship, we don't need to become best friends, but we are working partners. We are working together on our shared differences. We're restructuring the nature of the relationship between us. That's where the possibility lies. I don't know what the right way of saying it, but where it rests. It's in how we reconceive of the nature of our relationship. I call that this fancy thing, relational identity, but it really is just how do we restructure the nature of the relationship between us to make it most advantageous to our shared interests?
For me, this naturally begs the question of you're going to have a situation, because I'm going to presuppose that the only way for this to happen is for both parties to recognize that they either want to or need to come to an agreement. So both come in with their core identities, but they both want or need to come to an agreement. What happens when you have one party that doesn't necessarily want to come to an agreement? And is there a way to generate that desire so that it becomes more fluid?
I mean, that goes back to basic negotiation concepts that I'm sure you've already shared with your listeners, concepts like BATNA. You know, so just for the listener who may not be familiar with the term, there was a concept our organization coined many years back called your BATNA, your best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And this is a huge source of power in negotiations. So what is your walkaway alternative? If the price isn't right for the buyer or for the seller, where are they walking to? Is there another client? Is there another buyer at hand? One of the things I can do is try to weaken the other side's BATNA. They think that negotiation, I don't need to negotiate. I have plenty of other alternatives elsewhere. Well, maybe I could try and make those alternatives a little less attractive to the other side. Still within my moral realm, acting ethically, but I might be able to make that a little less attractive to them. So yeah, we've been working on this contract for 6 months now. Sure, you can walk elsewhere. I acknowledge you can do that. I could do that too. But think about the cost to you and your organization. If you walk away from this contract, you're going to have to build 6 months worth of data and relationship to get to the place we have. My thought is we might sit down and just try and figure out these last details to this negotiation, to this contract. I think we could have something that actually could be, you know, submitted to our bosses within the next week. But it's your choice. So I think BATNA, you weaken the other's BATNA, you can strengthen your BATNA so that you do not need to feel so very pressured to come to an agreement. The stronger your walkaway alternative, the more powerful you are at the negotiation table.
I'm going to segue the conversation to talk about the negotiation itself and what you start talking about as the lures of, I think you call it the lures of tribalism or the lures of the tribal mind, where you get into the whole context of like, okay, now that we've agreed that we want to come to some sort of a negotiation, right? We need to get to some sort of a result at the end of this. One of the things that you talk about is sacred sort of sanctity areas, sacred cows, so to speak, right? Where you have these things that are very sacred to the counterparty. And when you start, quote unquote, attacking those or questioning those areas, it becomes a very contentious sort of conflict in the negotiation itself. But the question is, sometimes you have to, right? Sometimes you have to get into a discussion, right, where you're like, okay, look, I recognize that this is a sacred area for you. This is part of your self-talk. I recognize that this is a sacred area for you, but we're going to have to go here at some point in time. When you get to these areas where you're challenging these, you know, sacred grounds where this counterparty has had for eons, how do you even approach that conversation?
I start by building the relationship. If you and I want to talk about something that is deeply meaningful to you or to me, I need to know I feel safe in this relationship. I need to know that I can trust you and that you can trust me enough that we can have a conversation and feel respected through it. So, you know, I think bringing, let me give you a real example. I work to train a number of senior level Israeli-Palestinian international diplomats. It was a few years ago, I was doing a training. It was about 8 months into a training program that these diplomats were going through. And we're in a remote area of the world, away from the public eye. We're doing a multi-day training. It's the evening. And I see some of the Israelis and the Palestinians over in a corner, about five of them huddled close by, leaning in, deeply enmeshed in some conversation. I look over, my eyes catch the eyes of one of the participants who looks back, very quickly returns to the conversation. And I could feel there was something happening there. And I didn't know what it was. And I was curious. A little bit later that evening, that particular colleague comes up to me and says, I just want to let you know, Dan, this was the first time that we have ever jointly cross lines, cross parties, cross groups, talked about the conflict, truly talked about the conflict. This was 8 months into an executive education training program. And initially my thought was, boy, 8 months into the program and you're just starting to talk about the real issues now. I'm thinking this in my head. And then I went, shame on you, Dan, shame on you. You're not living there. You do not understand what it actually means, the vulnerability it takes to talk about that, which is most deeply meaningful to us. And especially in this larger aura of trauma that is spread across much of the region, the sacred, how do you talk about that, which is sacred? You know, I think it's very difficult. You have families who are living together who might have grown up with different religions. You have the issue of race, people working together of different races. There is a lot that is sacred that's very difficult to talk about. I think the fundamental component to it, again, is helping people to build those relationships and establishing not just a safe space. I don't like that notion, safe. You know, the way I teach, it's not safe. It's brave. In the sense, it's a brave space that we're trying to establish. The idea is, look, if we're going to come together to talk about some serious issues, you're going to need to make yourself a little bit vulnerable. You need to be a little bit brave, and that's scary. And that's what I saw those Israelis and Palestinians doing. they took a jump, you know, and I think the jump was rewarding to them because they got to learn about the other's perspectives. But it is a jump. And when we're talking about the sacred, you know, if you and I have a real conversation, Mark, and your listeners can't see you nor me, but we're looking at each other on the Zoom screen right now, my face will start to get a little red. Your face might start to blush a little bit because it's tough stuff to talk about.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about another company that I run called Content Callout. It is a thought leadership brand marketing company. Now, what does that mean? It means that we take you as an executive or entrepreneur, a leader of a small or medium-sized business, and we turn you into a thought leader online. We take your personal brand and we amp it up to 11. So that you can lead with confidence, knowing that people will recognize you, recognize your brand, and recognize your business because of the thought leadership approach that you've taken on social media through content creation and content distribution, as well as engaging with all of your following online. How do you get involved in this? Easy, easy, easy. Just go to contentcallout.com/get-started, and you will see there three different options that will allow you to take your thought leadership brand for yourself and for your business to the next level. We are super excited to talk to you about this. We've seen some massive growth with the businesses that we've been working with. Very, very exciting time for us. Look at that. We appreciate it. Now back to your show. Does that also mean that there needs to be a willingness from the counterparty that holds that sacred ground to be challenged on those sacred things?
Probably. That's a good question. Probably to some degree. I think the more important part is that there's an understanding that the goal is learning and mutual respect. It's just so easy when we start talking about the sacred in international relations, for example, for each side to start making declarations.
Yeah, and that's when we get into identity politics, right? That's where it just starts going really badly.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think, and to speak to your bigger question, I mean, why does all this matter? And how did this all come about? My work in Eastern Europe, I was called in the mid-90s. Macedonia, what was then known as Macedonia, within the country, there was ethnic tension rising between the Macedonians and ethnic Albanians. And there was a possibility of civil war. And I, along with some colleagues, I developed this exercise that I call the tribes exercise, which you might be familiar with. And we ran it for the first time there. I've run it since, and I write about it in my book, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable. I write about doing that same exercise in Davos, Switzerland, with global leadership. And if it's okay with you, would it be okay to share that with
your
listeners?
That's awesome. I love this exercise. I think it's brilliant.
It's just to give the context, because that exercise speaks to the heart of what I do. Davos, the mountains of Switzerland, 2006. I was invited there to do this little exercise. We met in a small room in this big Congress hall. 45 global leaders shuffle into the room. I randomly divide them into six different groups, about eight people per table. And we had senior leadership there, everybody from deputy head of state to CEOs of Fortune 50 companies, this incredible artist, security and peace specialist from around the world. And I shared with them my belief that as much as we are becoming more and more connected as a global community, it's becoming harder in a way to connect. The more homogenized everything becomes, the more we want to find our own individuality. And this, I said, moves us into the realm of what I call a tribal world. Tribes being the most beautiful thing in the world, not in the indigenous. I'm not talking about tribes here specifically to indigenous populations, Native Americans. A tribe to me is any group to which you feel some sort of family-like connection. And I said to the group, you have this wonderful opportunity today to create your own tribe at your group, to create your own close-knit community. And they said, fine. I gave them a set of questions. I said, answer all of these questions to define your tribe. Dress up in your tribal outfit. You know, make this fun and crazy, but also take it for real. And 50 minutes later, they all come back, six different tables, each with their own crazy outfits on. They had defined their own identities, their own group identities. I get in front of the group In the most boring voice I can muster, I say, okay, let's debrief this exercise. And I knew what they were thinking. They're thinking, interesting exercise, but what's the point? What's the point of all this? And it's right at this moment that the lights go completely black in this room. Into the room barges this intergalactic alien. So this person dressed up as an alien who says, I am an intergalactic alien. I have come to destroy the Earth. I will give you one opportunity to save the world from complete destruction. You must choose one of these tribes to be the tribe of everybody. You'll have 3 rounds of negotiation. And if you cannot come to agreement by the end of these 3 rounds of negotiation, the world will be destroyed. Yeah. You know, and out floats that alien. And as ridiculous as this might sound, these global leaders took this exercise very seriously. Round one, they come to negotiate, no agreement. Round two, they go to negotiate, no agreement. And it moves to round three. 6 representatives, one from each tribe, comes to the center of the room. 5 men, 1 woman, just by chance. And the moment they get to the middle of this room, these men start yelling over one another. They're so into this exercise. They start yelling. This woman cannot get a word in, and she gets utterly enraged. Her hands are shaking. Her face is red. She stands on a bar stool, and she yells these words, I hope I never forget. She says, this is just another example of male competitive behavior. You all come to my tribe. You know, one tribe joins hers. The others refuse. And 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, boom.
Kaboom.
The world explodes at Davos with these world leaders. And I have run this exercise now dozens and dozens and dozens of times around the world. There in, you know, Macedonia years ago, in the mountains of Davos, with my students at Harvard, with students at MIT, with NGOs, with people in across parts of Asia, Australia, Latin America, and on, and almost without fail, the world explodes again and again. Identity. Over the course of 50 minutes, people feel so connected to a specific identity that they've created in that 50 minutes, that they would rather cling to that identity than save the world. This is what puzzled me. I watched this world explode again and again. This is a microcosm of conflict in our world, negotiation. It is rationally, of course, they all wanted to save the world, but something deeper was going on in negotiating the non-negotiable. What I discuss, as you're suggesting, 5 things that lure us toward that partisan mindset. And I call those things the 5 lures of the tribal mind. 5 lures of our party that move us toward partisanship, even when it does not serve our own interests, our closest interest rationally.
I just want to cover those 5 things for the listeners, because this is just I think when we get into the whole idea of me versus you, that's when things go south, right?
Exactly.
And this is kind of what we're talking about. So 5 lures of the tribal mind: vertigo, repetition, compulsion, taboos, assault on the sacred, and identity politics. We kind of talked about assault on the sacred and identity politics. Let's talk about taboos for a second, because this is taboos. They warn against sort of uttering words or acting in ways that can offend a culture or the people within it, right? So, and they're kind of like repetition compulsion, but explain to the listeners what taboos are and how to maybe deal with societal or tribal taboos when you're negotiating.
A taboo is a social prohibition. Mm. It is something you're not supposed to say, you're not supposed to do, you're not supposed to feel, you're not supposed to be that way. Mm. It's taboo. The way my mother-in-law put it, I like a lot. It's a big no-no. Don't do that, right? So, you know, your boss just hired his brother-in-law to take the senior position in the organization. And the brother-in-law doesn't seem very qualified for the position, but boy, it's a big taboo. You don't want to talk about that. In my own household growing up, you know, in small ways, we see it in our family. Try hugging my father. Good luck. Like, this feels very uncomfortable. It's taboo. And every organization has its taboos. Every family has their own taboos. Mom is, boy, she's drinking a lot during the pandemic. This is not healthy for her. You can see it causing her to go down, but I can't talk about it. Because if we talk about it, boy, the problem of breaking a taboo is social punishment, some sort of punishment. Mom, you're drinking too much alcohol. Oh, don't you tell me. And then you get the silent treatment for the next week.
But if you don't challenge mom on that, then there's the risk of that getting really, really bad. And this is the point that I want to get to in this discussion, because taboos are, you know, they're kind of, in a sick way, they kind of hold society together in a lot of circumstances. But in other ways, if you don't start to challenge some of those taboos, especially if they're unhealthy and they're not going to move the conversation forward, then that's really dangerous.
Absolutely. It's a great point. The question then is, one, you need to recognize that there is a taboo. In my own family, what's making this family dysfunctional? A family business, let's say. Can't raise the issue with mom or dad. What is that issue? What's the taboo? And then if you do see it as dysfunctional, then the question is, well, what do I do with it? Do you want to break it? Do you want to take that risk? And if the answer is, well, maybe, yeah. You know, even just a maybe, yeah. Now, how can you possibly do that? So let me give you an example outside the everyday realm. So back to the Middle East. It is, for many, absolutely a taboo for Israeli and Palestinian leadership to meet together. Just like for many different political reasons and sometimes personal reasons. But Israelis and Palestinians do not meet. There's no avenue for real communication and the conflict will continue. So what do you do? And puzzled me, and it was a serious concern and is. And so one example that I write about in the book is a workshop that we gave a few years back that I had created, bringing together Israelis, Palestinians, internationals from other parts of the world to talk about some of the taboos that were constraining positive communication.
I like that. Okay. Tell me more about this.
This was in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. It was a session of the World Economic Forum. So you have all these international leaders there under this sort of iron dome of the World Economic Forum, a safe space outside the media context. And we, for months, tried to figure out who could we invite that actually can make a difference and so on. Got this very esteemed group of influencers into a room. The session opened with Tony Blair starting off the session, talking about taboos in the Northern Ireland context. It was nice to have Mr. Blair there because he was sort of a magnet who brought everybody we wanted into the session. What we did was before that session, we surveyed people across the region and said, what are some of the big issues that people are scared to death to talk about? The taboos. Jerusalem, we can't talk about that. The name Israel, the name Palestine, people won't even say the name, right? So all of these things we created, it was about eight groups. In the middle of the room, we had a little stand cordoned off with a blue rope there. And in the middle of that were envelopes. And in each envelope was a taboo. Mm-hmm. Each group went to the middle of the room, grabbed an envelope out of the middle, brought it back to their small group, which was a mixed group of Israelis, Palestinians, Arabs, internationals. And then they spent the next hour talking about that taboo. So what are the pros of that taboo? What are the cons? Is it feasible to possibly break that taboo? How could we imagine that happening? And then at the close of the session, they still had that taboo in their hand. The question now was, do you want to keep it, try and work on it? Or do you want to bring it back to the middle of the room, place that taboo where it was at the beginning, and you are free of contamination. You know, you're pure still.
This is such a clever exercise because you're talking about the taboo. You're not necessarily debating the thing, right? So you're not getting stuck in the conversation. The conversation is about that thing that people get stuck in. It's so interesting.
Exactly. And the conversation was extremely lively, extremely powerful, to the extent that afterward, there was enough momentum that this led to another whole project that moved forward a new set of formal political negotiations a number of years back. But it sort of broke the ice on some difficult issues that people were scared to death to talk about. By the way, Mark, to your point, the other side is that taboos aren't all bad. You know, there's a taboo in family life. You're not supposed to punch your children or your spouse if you disagree. That's sort of a good taboo, you know, and there are plenty of those taboos. And I do think that one of the things that we as a global society and as nations can do is to think through what other taboos might we want to establish that actually are positive.
Exactly.
Don't do this and you're going to be cooler. It's a norm. Yeah.
It takes a considerable amount of effort and planning, though, I find, to challenge taboos or even to challenge sacred areas. Because when you come into these sort of strongly held societal, everyone believes in this one thing, it's an unwritten rule.
Yeah.
And you can't just go in and say, well, listen, this is bullshit, right? Like, we can't do this anymore, because immediately you're going to create conflict by saying that. So you've got to warm them up. And I love how you did that, to talk about the taboo itself and not necessarily get involved in the debate of Jerusalem, you know, who does that belong to, right?
Exactly.
Like that conversation is just going to end up getting you nowhere. But right. to talk about the taboo itself, to say, why is it that we talk about this, right? Mm-hmm. It's so interesting, fascinating.
In everyday life, within the organizational context, taboos are very much there. You know, so as much as there is good work being done on racial justice, gender justice, social justice, and so on, there's still a lot of work to be done. And you have somebody who might feel discriminated against within an organization on the basis of, let's say, race or gender, but there may still be a taboo to raise that issue. Mm. Well, no, our institution has a working group that's talking about it, so you don't need to raise those concerns. They're already being taken care of. I think the question becomes, if people feel some sort of grievance and it is connected to a taboo, how do you create the right conditions to talk about it? It may be best not to talk about some sensitive taboos with 35 people all on Zoom listening in. It may be best to quietly say to your boss over, you know, meeting, just a random meeting, I'd like to talk to you about something sensitive and to get your thoughts on this. I've noticed that there's a pattern to who is getting called on in our meetings here. And this is an awkward conversation for me to raise, but I felt it was important to raise. And I'd love your thoughts on that. And, you know, if you have ideas on what all of us can do to improve the conditions here.
And I think this really comes down to the basics of communication of, you know, not being accusational and I feel versus you do and that kind of like basic communication stuff.
Absolutely.
But I think a lot of people don't necessarily have that level of training. And that's, it's shocking because there's so much work out there that's basically free that you can go and like access and sort of make your communication better. And to that end, maybe we'll close off with this. First of all, what's the one piece of advice with your most recent work and obviously Beyond Reason, everything that centers around making sure that conflicts get resolved in an expedient manner and that you have the way to manage conflicts in an ongoing basis. What's the one piece of advice you want to leave the listeners with today?
Appreciate. This word, when I first heard it in the negotiation context, struck me as naive, simplistic, soft, and fuzzy. Appreciate. I have come to believe that that is the essential tool to effective negotiation. In the political realm, in the business realm, and trying to get along with your family member at home. What do I mean by that? You know, I don't mean just be grateful. This is a very specific set of tactics that one can put into practice in a negotiation. To appreciate means three things. It means one, I understand your perspective. People stop there though. I think I understand my colleague's perspective, but why are they such a jerk? You know, you're always such a, it's true. They might cognitively understand, you know, you, Mark and I, we get into a conflict. I might understand everything about your perspective, but if I'm conveying in a way that makes you feel like I think you're crazy, it's not appreciation. And we're going to distance. We're going to move away from one another. Step two is finding merit, finding value in what the other person thinks or feels or does. And thirdly, letting them know, communicating that new, deeper understanding to them. It doesn't mean that I agree with you. It means I understand and I see the merit. You know, I'm walking down the street and I see somebody who walks up to me and says, oh, the world is flat, the world is flat, the world is flat. I could say, you know what, you're crazy. The world is not flat. Have you looked at NASA technology and pictures and so on? No appreciation there. Or I could say, you know what, sir? I'm looking at the street in front of us. That does look flat. Let's look at Google on my little phone here. That does look flat. I see where you're coming from and I see the sense in what you're saying. At the same time, let me share with you some of my own thinking on why I think the world is a bit more curved. I'm not rejecting. I am appreciating. And it doesn't mean I'm soft. Just the opposite. This semester, as an example, one of the activities I put forward for my students was a civil discourse project. Said to them, you're going to be meeting with 8 fellow students 5 times. You're going to identify an extremely sensitive political issue, and you are going to be going deep into that issue over 5 sessions. Mm. And what's the challenge? The challenge is trying to really appreciate others' perspectives. There's no conversion going on. This is relational identities. I'm not trying to convert anybody else to my way of thinking or me to theirs. It's pure understanding and appreciation. And the problem in negotiation is that we often go in wanting the other to appreciate our perspective, but we're not appreciating theirs.
Not being willing to go the extra mile to be able to appreciate. Yeah, look, you need to understand where I'm coming from.
Exactly. And it's true. You do. And that is your power. You know, so even in the most contentious negotiations, my advice generally would be start by appreciating their perspective. Trying to understand and see the merit. You don't have to agree, but try to understand it. And this could take you 5 minutes. This could take you 5 days. But what I can almost promise, right? I can promise in most circumstances, if that other side feels truly heard and understood and valued, they're going to open up like a blooming flower to listen to you, to appreciate you. So appreciate. This is just as true. You mentioned you have a wide variety of different listeners. I think it's just as true in business as it is in hostage negotiation. There, I've worked with NYPD's hostage negotiation team, with FBI's negotiation unit. There too. I mean, what's the critical skill? You could say it's empathy, it's active listening, it's all these things. It is appreciating. I want to understand your perspective. And once you understand that, you are in a wholly different place.
Whenever I read your work, I'm captivated, very captivated by what you write. I find it completely fascinating and very engrossing. So thank you very much for all the amazing work that you do. How do people find you online and where do they go to get your work?
Sure. So first, thank you for your very generous words. I appreciate it. My website is Dan Shapiro Global. I think that's all you need. I think it's .com. I should know that. DanShapiroGlobal.com. And the two most recent books, one is Beyond Reason, Using Emotions as You Negotiate. In that, we talk about five core emotional concerns that we all have in negotiation and how to deal with them, appreciation being number one. And the newest book is, Mark, what you mentioned earlier, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Both of them are available on Amazon and many different independent bookstore websites as well.
Fascinating, man. Loved having you on. This was a great discussion. We'll definitely have to get you back soon. For the listeners, just so that you know, we'll link out to all of the resources that we spoke about in the show notes. You just have to check that out on the website. Dan, again, thank you so much for being here.
Mark, thank you so much. This has been amazing. Thank you.
Hey, friends. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.